You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, the Ukrainian military says the defenders of Mariupol have ended their mission after more than 260 fighters were taken to a Russian-controlled territory from the Azovstal steel plant. Then,
I got used to listening to my grandfather's stories of what he saw at the front line, or my grandmother's unending longing for the house she grew up in, lost to the wrong side of the new border when the war ended.
We'll hear a personal take on how NATO membership feels for a formerly pacifist Finn. We'll cross to Colombo for the latest developments in the political and economic crisis affecting Sri Lanka, and then to Havana, where a new penal code is introduced as the USA eases restrictions on Cuba. Plus, what next for Olaf Scholz? As his Social Democrat Party posts historically bad results in local elections, what does this mean for the German coalition? We'll go through the international front pages and get the latest technology news, then head to Barcelona to visit a landmark of the Catalan capital. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. Now we begin with the latest from Ukraine. I'm joined by Victoria Vishnevska from the Independent Anti-Corruption Commission in Ukraine. Victoria, many thanks for joining us once again. What can you tell us about the evacuation from the steelworks?
We do know for sure that the evacuation is in process. Ukrainian officials, they do not comment that much as the agreement is fragile. And I would say that the whole this whole story is very fragile in general, because Ukraine tried many different options on how to evacuate the people from Azovstal. That includes the procedure of extraction with the help of third parties, but Russia refused all of them as they want this particular regiment to surrender, well, for propaganda purposes and ego purposes as well, I would say. So surrendering was not an option for them. And as we do know now, there are more than 200 soldiers that are heavily injured, that they're being transferred to the occupied areas for allegedly medical treatment. And as a, if everything goes well, they will be able to go back to Ukraine, to the territories that we control, as prisoners, in the context of prisoner exchange procedure. But again, as I said, things are very complicated, and everything can go well, can go badly very easily. So the whole agreement is fragile.
Russia has said, however, that a lot of these captured soldiers might be war criminals in their eyes, and in that case would not be eligible for a prisoner swap. Do we know where exactly they've been taken, what conditions they've been kept in, and if indeed that is the case, if they might be tried for crimes against Russians?
Well, first, we do know two cities that they are allegedly been taken. We do not know whether or not they're there yet. We have like little information on that because, as I said before, Ukrainian government is very concerned about how they command everything that goes. As for the Russian side, yes, Russian officials said that they actually need to bring Azov to the court, not exchange them. Some of the Russian officials also said that they propose to execute them publicly in Mariupol for the alleged crimes that they've done. Well, they literally say everything that's possible to say about this particular regiment. However, one thing that we have to keep in mind is that their Azovstal not only had the soldiers from the Azov battalion. There are also Marines, National Guard, National Police, a lot of different parts of Ukrainian army. So speaking of them as a generalized community of, so to speak, were criminals is, well, it's not true, obviously. Mm-hmm. Knowing the history that Russia, however, likes to like paint any kinds of Ukrainian army as war criminals is also a thing that we have to consider, because Russia likes to lie. And also they like to lie a lot about Azov.
In terms of Azov, though, it does have quite a conflicted history, that regiment.
Yes, obviously. Yes, they emerged back in 2014 as a far-right organization, a far-right volunteer battalion. But with time that has passed, they kind of evolved. I would say that they're right now less ideologically painted, because this particular regiment, first and foremost, it has the reputation of very effective soldiers. They also have the reputation of, I would say, that the boss enemy of Russians. Russians are really scared of them. And this battalion right now includes a lot of different people from different nationalities, from, I would say from my observation, personal ones, is that this battalion is usually joined not for the ideological purposes, but rather because they're hardcore warriors. So people really want to be part of this particular regiment. Mm. But yes, they did have the reputation of being far right. However, right now it's far from true.
Mm. So does the extraction of these soldiers mean that Mariupol is lost?
Yes, obviously.
There was an extraordinary interview on Russian state television in which a military strategist and a retired air defence commander told viewers that the population had been lied to, the Russian population, that is. What else did he say? And could this have been sanctioned by the Kremlin, or was it a rare case of somebody in authority actually telling the truth?
you have to know that everything that is said on Russian state TV is sanctioned. There is no, like, if there is some kind of a debate, some kind of controversy, it is usually sanctioned. People know what they have to tell. So we're skeptical about this particular comment. The man, if I'm not mistaken, he's known for being kind of opposing to this war, from the practical side of it, not like from humanitarian. So he said a lot of things. And the main one is that the war is not going well. The war will not end well. So obviously Russian people need to, they need to think of it not in the way that the Russian propaganda wants them to think. However, as I said before, it's very tricky. We may think that Russian TV channels, they kind of prepare their audience for some further propaganda narratives to emerge. So we have to be careful with anything that they say on their state TV.
Mm. I wonder how the loss of Mariupol is being covered, not only on from the Russian side, but within Ukraine, and what it means for Ukraine.
It means a lot for Ukraine, because Mariupol is the center of the atrocities. First and foremost, we've seen how much the city has been destroyed. We do know what Russians do right now there to the civilians. We do know that they are easily destroying everything Ukraine related there. So it's painful for us to watch it, obviously. Also, with the Azovstal, as President Zelensky once said, when Azovstal stops breathing, the heart of Ukraine dies. So this is why it is very important for us at that moment to save as many lives as possible, because this whole Azovstal story is just the finest example of bravery and courage. And yes, we definitely care a lot about those soldiers. We definitely want them to like be as safe as it's possible for them at this moment. As I said before, if Azovstal stops breathing, Ukraine heart will die.
Victoria, finally, how are Ukrainians reacting to the news of Finland's plans to join NATO?
Well, we're happy for them. It would have been nicer for us to have something like that. But unfortunately, Ukraine is not Finland. But yeah, you know, at this point, we are seeing what Russian officials are saying about Finland. And we do understand that they're bothered with Finland joining NATO, but not that much like to invade them. And they will not invade them. Knowing that, it is particularly hilarious, I would say, to recall this argument that Ukraine should be invaded because of the NATO expansion in this particular region. So we're kind of looking skeptical at those people. We did look skeptical at those people who said that this whole war is about NATO's expansion. We right now definitely see that it was not about NATO's expansion. It was for Russia's internal reasons only. So I wish good luck to Finland. And I hope that when the war ends, we'll be on the same side with them.
Victoria, thank you very much indeed. That's Victoria Vishnevska there speaking to us from Ukraine. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Now, as we just mentioned, a landmark vote in the Finnish Parliament yesterday afternoon saw overwhelming support in favour of the country joining NATO. Long considered a potentially antagonistic move towards Russia, the recent invasion of Ukraine has left Finland with little choice but to try and join the alliance in order to protect itself. Well, here's Monocle's Markus Hippi with a personal reflection on what this watershed moment means for the country and its people.
For my generation, growing up in Finland meant growing up with the memory of the Second World War and the fight against the Soviet Union. I got used to listening to my grandfather's stories of what he saw at the front line, or my grandmother's unending longing for the house she grew up in, lost to the wrong side of the new border when the war ended. The decades that followed the Second World War were defined by fear of Russia. The main goal of those in power in Helsinki was to guarantee the peace and security of our land and people. Decisions revolved around how Moscow would feel about them. At times, the repeated mantra of an eternal Finnish-Soviet friendship resembled a form of group psychosis.
Good evening. The red flag came down over the Kremlin tonight as President Gorbachev resigned and brought to an end 7 decades of communist rule in the Soviet Union.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States,
the fall of the Soviet Union and Finland's EU membership in 1994 began to change the dynamics. My country felt more independent and proud as its gaze shifted to the West. It became more international and began to see its relationship with Russia as an asset. Surely Finland would understand Moscow better than most other countries, thanks to our close contacts. The idea of NATO membership felt unnecessary as it would only cause tensions. This year has changed everything.
It's more in our minds. If you know that you have a secure country to live and build and work, that has an impact to all of your behavior, even if you don't daily remember it. It gives security of mind.
The Finnish people have taken Russia's invasion of Ukraine personally, and as the Finnish Parliament gave its final approval for our NATO application, the extraordinary majority of MPs supporting the move makes clear just how fundamentally the way in which we see our place next to Russia and in the world has changed. We don't know what the future holds, but what we do know is that if we become NATO members, we won't be alone again if history repeats itself one day.
That was Monocle's Markus Hippi there. A no-confidence motion tabled by the opposition against Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapaksa was defeated in Parliament yesterday, marking a comfortable win for the embattled president amidst nationwide protests demanding his resignation due to the country's worst ever economic crisis. Rajapaksa's elder brother, Mahinda Rajapaksa, resigned as the Prime Minister to make way for the President to appoint an interim all-political party government. And this was the first time Parliament met since the appointment of the new Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe. Last Thursday, Wickremesinghe has warned that the country urgently needs $75 million in foreign exchange to pay for essential imports. Well, I'm joined now by Tanya Warnakulasiria, who's a journalist and a writer based in Colombo. Tanya, lovely to have you with us. Why did this vote fail, given the level of protests against Rajapaksa?
The vote failed because basically the cabinet is still looking to Gotabaya to run the country and is still sort of beholden and controlled by him.
But I mean, even the new prime minister voted against it, and he was formerly in opposition. Why would he want Rajapaksa to stay?
Well, it's very interesting. Ranil is seen by many as the sort of the beleaguered president's puppet. For example, he seems to say things to placate the public, but then actually does very little to activate that due process in response to public sentiment. So as you said, yesterday that opposition parties asked Parliament to put aside standing orders and discuss the public's overwhelming displeasure with the president. And announcements were made that the Prime Minister's party was very much in favour of doing that. And yet when it came to it, the Prime Minister suggested that a vote be taken on whether to discuss or not. And we know that he himself voted not to discuss the country's lack of faith in the president. So there's this publicly appeasing face to the Prime Minister, and then a very contrasting political side, which the public is deeply mistrustful of and continues to demonstrate against.
And how have the public reacted to this vote?
Outrage, very, very angry. There's sort of a lot of I told you so, and this is what he does. Ranil is, he's come to power 6 times through his political life. So he's known to want to hold this post, and the public are very, very cynical about the whole thing.
Now, Ranil has uttered some dire warnings about the state of the economy. What did he say?
Well, he addressed the nation 2 days ago and told us that basically what we already know, that the next couple of months are going to be incredibly severe for the country. Now, what exactly that means is anyone's guess, given that we are already undergoing severe food, medicine and fuel shortages and rocketing prices on what we can get. He explained that the country has a budget deficit of $2.4 trillion, and that the Treasury can't even lay its hands on $1 million in foreign reserves, which is the vital currency that's needed to pay for these essential supplies. So, we're hearing reports of ships being moored on the coast of Sri Lanka for weeks containing fuel and gas that we can't pay for, and so it can't be unloaded. And as you said, $75 million is required to pay for the fuel. And so he said that currently, we had 1 day's stock of petrol. And so the last 2 days, we were told not to queue for petrol because all petrol stations would be shut for the next 3 days. Of course, that didn't stop people. People were advised not to queue, but yesterday, there were queues running for many kilometres outside almost every petrol station that I saw. Everyone generally for the last few months has been queuing on average about 5 hours for fuel. Yesterday, I spoke to a couple of three-wheelers drivers, and they'd been queuing. I spoke to them at 8 p.m., so they'd been queuing since 8 a.m. that morning. It's very dire. He also said that we might have to go back to 15-hour power cuts a day, which in tropical heat is absolutely unbearable. We're currently down to 3-hour power cuts daily, but I understand that outside of Colombo, it's a lot worse. So this is currently, the doom and gloom that we're undergoing. And I think the question that remain, there are still questions that remain unanswered, and a distinct lack of accountability and transparency that needs to be addressed.
And has Ranil put forward any plans to fix this?
He's approached, I think in his first few days, he approached a lot of foreign governments who said they were committed to helping. There were no sort of absolute commitments of money, but there are dialogues happening. And I still feel that, you know, for the IMF to come on board, there needs to be some semblance of a stable political cabinet that the IMF and institutions like the World Bank can rely on to come on board and actually, you know, activate some of those debt restructures and the loans that need to be given.
Are the protests continuing?
Protests are absolutely continuing. Yeah, they're not stopping. A lot of the young people, you know, there's a simple flowchart that's been circulating, which just says that they're still adamant that the president needs to go. There is a total lack of faith. And actually with Ranil, though he is certainly trying to be more accountable and more public facing and has certainly said that he will protect the protesters' right to peaceful protest and is investigating the riots and investigating the pro-government supporters that attacked the protesters. There is still cynicism about Ranil really being the yes man for the president. So there isn't that faith in the government is still not there.
So, I mean, back to my first question, really. If the demonstrators just want Rajapaksa to go, how long can he stay in the face of these protests?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, if you know, from his announcements, he's prepared to stay for the next couple of years until then there is an election and for him to be, you know, him to be voted out. But the public will not stop. The protests will not stop. And so it's a case of trying to follow due process and trying to, you know, have a party or a cabinet in place that is responsive and speaking to the mandate of the people, and that's not there at the moment.
Tanya, that's Tanya Warner-Kula-Saria. Thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll investigate Cuba's new penal code. We'll flick through the front pages. We'll look at the state of Germany's domestic politics. And we'll visit a building in Barcelona, which has been given a new lease of life. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Just coming up to 7:23 here in London. That's 2:23 in Havana, which is where we're off to next. As the White House begins to take the first steps towards renormalization of relations with Cuba by easing some restrictions, Havana has announced that Parliament has approved a new penal code, which some fear may impact negatively on human rights. Well, joining me now here in the studio is Yossi Meckelberg, who's Associate Fellow at Chatham House and a former Professor of International Relations at Regent's University. Yossi, it's lovely to have you back in the studio after 2 years.
Wonderful to be here again.
I wonder, and I know this is a big ask, but if you could give us a quick recent history lesson on Cuba-USA relations.
Well, I think the United States always seen Cuba as a bit of an extension of the United States. Twice in history, tried to actually purchase Cuba, and in 1898, actually liberated from Spanish rule in what is known as the Splendid Little War. And for 3 years, it actually controlled Cuba until it sort of granted it independence under the Platt Amendment, but still been in control of its foreign relations and its economy, which was abrogated in 1937. The revolution in 1959 was really the watershed there, when Cuba eventually became a communist country aligned with the Soviet Union and with the Bay of Pigs and the invasion of Cuba that failed, of course, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Since then, Cuba, I think it's more than the United States is a sworn enemy of Cuba. It's the United States, strangely enough, see a small island, quite impoverished, as a threat to it. But I think it's important to remember, as a result of the revolution, many Cubans emigrated mainly to Florida, but to other parts of the United States. Since then, Cuba is mainly a domestic issue in American politics. If you want to win election in Florida, you need to be nice to the Cubans that live in Florida that are actually sworn enemies of the government in Havana.
So is that what's behind this US move to ease restrictions now? What have they said and how are they going to pull back?
Well, the Cuban economy is in dire straits, no doubt about it. It's a combination of COVID, which deprived it of tourism for 4 million tourists per year to less than 600,000. A rising cost as a result of COVID, food shortages, the war now in the Ukraine. Russia is still an ally of Cuba. Fuel prices, food prices going up. There are blackouts, there are shortage of medicine. I think the expulsion of the medical staff from Brazil, 12,000 used to work. It's a huge income for Cuba along the years, exporting medical staff. So all of this created a major crisis. In addition to the transition that Cuba is going from the Castros to the new generation, and having a mixed economy between still there is one party centralized economy, but at the same time allow even private property, private enterprise collaboration with foreign investment. And it works very slowly. And the sanction and the sanction imposed by Trump under the Obama administration, some of the sanctions that were imposed back under the Eisenhower administration in 1960 were eased. President Obama visited Havana in March of 2016. And Trump, as an elephant in a China shop, reimposed the sanction, make things even worse for Cuba. And I think the Biden administration realized that A, it makes things worse for the United States. It makes things also worse because more Cubans try to emigrate. 100,000 probably emigrated, left Cuba in the last year. So there is also pressure on immigration. And what the Biden administration is trying to do is to ease this pressure by relieving some of the sanctions.
Now, we know that there's still a register of companies linked to the communist government in Havana that with whom US citizens are barred from doing business. So it's not a complete relaxation. What it does do is, it, as you say, it begins to roll back some of the measures put in place by Donald Trump. Now, he put those measures in place apparently because of human rights violations. Yeah. Many worry that this new penal code, though, that's just been approved, will stop any kind of dissent in the country, which kind of proves Trump right. I mean, can you tell us, I hate to say that, can you tell us what this code actually contains?
I don't think Trump was the biggest champion of human rights and that he would do it just because of human rights. It's almost a domestic politics and pressures. Bear in mind, two senators out of 100 in the United States, at the end of Cubans, Bob Menendez and Marco Rubio. And there's one Democrat and one Republican. Mm. It's become a real issue domestically. And Trump, during the election campaign, promised to reimpose the sanction.
Yeah.
So it's more to do with human rights. Again, obviously, the record of human rights in Cuba is not good enough.
But does this new penal code affect
And this penal code will make it even worse because it's deprived some of the human rights organization and the media of finances that coming from abroad. And this is a kind of a trick, if you like, that many governments are doing, especially in poor countries. You deprive independent journalists, you deprive human rights, NGOs, or organization of finances from abroad, and they basically can't function, let alone there is detention of journalists. But if you look at the other side, you know, there are two approaches. Either more pressure on Cuba, like people like Senator Mendez and Rubio would like. But this haven't worked for more than 60 years. Mm-hmm. There are more than 63 years. So actually engagement with people, supporting organizations, they're having a constructive conversation as Cuba through transition, I think that's what Obama started. Maybe Biden is continuing this by rolling back what the sanction can actually work better. And the second thing, obviously, any violation of human rights is not right, and they need to be condemned. But Cuba is not the worst offender. And if the United States also really put criteria and impose sanctions on country violate human rights, Cuba won't be top of the list.
Mm-hmm. What are the positives coming out of the changes to this penal code?
I think there is no, you know, the penal codes when it comes, for instance, it doesn't go as far as we would like in protecting, for instance, women. And actually, Raul Castro's daughter, who is a member of the assembly, they're trying to push more the issue of women and tougher punishment when it comes to femicide and the rest. But it goes some way into protecting women, in protecting children. There is still an issue of having children put in jail under 16. So there are a lot of issues there that Cuba hasn't reformed, but it's doing step by step in its own pace, and that's the way I think working with Cuba in reforming its legal system would work better than punishing it.
Yossi, thank you very much indeed. That's Yossi Meckelberg there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Violence broke out in Libya's capital, Tripoli, yesterday as one of the two rival prime ministers entered the capital to claim the role. He fled just a matter of hours later after seeing the level of military opposition he was faced with, claiming he did so to avoid bloodshed. He's now said that he'll base his government in the city of Sirte. A trade war between the European Commission and the UK is looking increasingly likely if UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss continues with plans to rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Commissioners pledged to respond with all measures at its disposal if the changes go ahead. And the Monocle Minute today reports on how Los Angeles will implement some of its harshest ever water restrictions to combat a severe drought. The city hopes that the measures will slash its water use by 35%. You can read more on that story by heading to monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Just after halfway through the hour, and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats have done very poorly in two recent state elections. They were defeated on Sunday by the Christian Democratic Union in North Rhine-Westphalia. The week before, they suffered a humiliating loss to the CDU in the northern state of Schleswig-Holstein. Meanwhile, the Greens more than doubled their share to 18.2%. That's a record for the party. Well, joining me now from Berlin is Suda David Wilp, who's Deputy Director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office. Suda, lovely to have you with us as ever. I wonder what this means for Scholz personally. In Rhine-Westphalia, the SPD involved Scholz personally in the campaign. I wonder if you think that was the reason for the historic loss. Can you talk us through those numbers and what it means?
Sure. Good morning, Georgina. Yes, you know, even in April, Chancellor Scholz was having a hard time at the polls because of his hesitation in terms of leadership with regard to the war in Ukraine. You know, Germany was going back and forth about how it can support Ukraine, whereas many countries within NATO had more of a concrete stance on the situation. But you're very right. The latest two state elections in Germany really shows that the SPD is not doing well, and that actually has ramifications for Berlin. These past two state elections, especially the one on Sunday in North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's most populous state, is kind of a bellwether for national politics and also a stronghold for the SPD. And they actually had the worst result ever. So with, I think, 27% of the vote.
Mm. Just looking at Schleswig-Holstein, to be fair, the SPD never really expected to do particularly well there, did they?
Well, Daniel Günther is a very popular minister president, the incumbent from the CDU. He's also a very moderate member of the CDU and has found a way of working well with his coalition partners, the Greens and the FDP. And I think people see this as a model, actually, for the national level. In fact, last year, many people were thinking that Germany would have a black-green coalition, meaning a tie-up between the Conservatives and the Greens. Mm. It didn't happen. Olaf Scholz was the unexpected winner. But this could be sort of a headwind for 2025.
Why are the Greens doing so well?
Well, the Greens are doing very well because of two charismatic leaders in Berlin, specifically the foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, and the economics and climate protection minister, Robert Habeck. They're among the most popular politicians in Germany. They have also are very they're very effective communicators, and I think that has played down ballot in those state elections in Schleswig-Holstein and North Rhine-Westphalia.
Mm. In terms then of future coalitions, I mean, one would then expect the Greens to be included, but who with, and could they prop them up on their own?
Well, the Greens have certainly cemented their role as kingmaker in German politics, now on the state level and even on the national level, from what we saw also last year. What's also interesting is the FDP, the Free Democrats, who are part of the three-way tie-up in Berlin at the moment. They did not perform very well. And it could be that the coalition in Berlin is not helping its reputation as a party of fiscal discipline, because the finance minister and vice chancellor, Christian Lindner, is now being party to creating debt in Germany. But nobody expected this war last year. And I think the party is suffering as an account for it.
So, I mean, finally, do you think that the current coalition is in peril?
I don't think the current coalition is in peril at the moment, but I'm sure Olaf Scholz is thinking whether his partners will stick with him for a second term. I do think that this coalition was very earnest in getting things done for Germany. They had a very strong domestic agenda, but the war in Ukraine really threw them for a loop. They did not expect to have these foreign policy challenges. But the question is whether it could be sustainable for a second term.
Suda, thank you very much indeed. That was Suda David Wilp, who's deputy director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Just coming up to 7:37 here in London, 8:37 in Zurich, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Simon Brook, who's a journalist and a communications consultant. And I have to point this out, as ever, formerly with the Conservative Party here in Britain.
I've forgotten about that.
The reason I want to bring that up is that's our first story, because if I've got this right, and please feel free to explain this to me in words of one syllable, if you
without
can.
Without swearing, yes.
The British government negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol. They are now saying that the EU must help them roll back the protocol. They no longer want the very deal that they negotiated themselves. And everybody all round, the EU and the British government, including the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, are getting very bullshy about it.
They are indeed, yeah, absolutely. And the Belfast Telegraph leads with this story. Now, I should say the Telegraph reports that the government has been very clear that it is not seeking to scrap the protocol. But certainly there's a lot of unhappiness, as you can imagine. And the Telegraph is quoting various people. It quotes on the positive side. It quotes Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the leader of the DUP, which is, of course, the party which really needs to get back into government with Sinn Féin to get things moving again in Northern Ireland. He didn't say that he would return to his party would return to Stormont following the intervention from Liz Truss. But he wants to see progress in days and weeks, not months, he says. Yes, obviously, the EU has responded. Its vice president, Maros Sefcovic, has said that any move to unilaterally override parts of the protocol raises serious concerns. There's obviously a lot of anger in Northern Ireland, as you can imagine. Sinn Féin's leader, Michelle O'Neill, has said that any move to do this sort of unilateral override puts Northern Ireland in a very dangerous place due to potential conflict with the EU. The president of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald, is quoted in a tweet in the Telegraph saying the British government announces its intention to legislate to break the law, the stuff of a rogue state. So, yeah, as you can imagine, local politicians are very unhappy about this. And it's not clear, really, from the Telegraph piece and generally what Liz Truss means when she she says that she's going to sort of tear it up, but she's not. But she's still going to respect international law.
Are you saying obfuscation from the Tory party?
Yeah. Perhaps if you could help out on this one, it would be interesting to see. But certainly it's going to be very controversial. It'll be interesting to see how the government really thinking about its own backbenchers, very pro-Brexit backbenchers, how it sort of walks this tightrope.
I'm sure we'll be returning to this story again and again. Let's go to France now, because, of course, President Macron has announced his new prime minister. What does this mean?
Yes, so a bit more analysis of in Le Monde of the announcement which was made last Monday, which is that Elizabeth Borne is to be the prime minister, as you say. So as the paper points out, she's there in a way to counter the threat from the left in the forthcoming assembly elections. So the paper reports that the feeling is that the right is very much vanquished, if you like, by Macron. But what he's concerned about is the rise of Jean-Luc Mélenchon and this sort of green socialist alliance. The problem is, of course, if they do well, then he is not going to get the majority he needs in the French National Assembly to sort of put through his programme. So the idea is that she can sort of draw some of the sting from the election. She's never actually stood for election herself, even though she's been very instrumental in the French Socialist Party. But she is standing in the Calvados region. I can never report on French politics without associating it with sort of food and drink and stuff. But what a lovely idea. She is, anyway, that's where she's going to be a candidate. And as I say, Le Monde hopes that this woman, the first woman in the post for more than 30 years, actually will be able to sort of smooth the process for Macron's legislative programme.
Let's go on to another powerful woman now. And this is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who's leader of the Belarus opposition in exile. And she's talking about sanctions and how this affects Belarus.
Yeah, very important. I mean, this is just to give a little bit of background on the Kyiv Independent, which has the interview. This is Ukraine's English language paper. It's born out of the Kyiv Post, which was a paper which closed in November last year after its leadership put pressure on journalists there to follow, the sort of the Putin line. But yeah, very interesting. She says, the leader of the opposition says, there will be a moment when Putin and Lukashenko, the dictator in Belarus, get weaker, and it will be the chance for Belarusians to get our country back. So this very brave woman reminds us that Putin doesn't recognise Belarus and Ukraine as independent countries. So they've got something in common there, sees them as vassals. If the opposition in Belarus is broadening its activities, according to the piece. And if it does enjoy more success, then it's a sort of more leverage, if you like, to just push Putin's forces out of Ukraine and win a victory for both countries and, of course, democracy and human rights.
Of course, because, I mean, she's saying that before they were fighting only against dictatorships and for free and fair elections. Now she says it's for the very existence of the country.
Yeah, absolutely, that it will be subsumed into this new sort of Soviet Union Mark II, as Putin would like to see. But it's interesting to see that there really ought to be more focus on her, I think, in a way, and the Belarusian opposition. Position, because I think even though they are struggling, they are key to this this extra flank, if you like, in terms of the opposition to President Putin.
She's talking about not protesting, that those in Belarus are not protesting, and she says this is our way to help. What does she mean by that?
Well, I think there's obviously real concerns, isn't there? I mean, Lukashenko is a violent thug by any standards, I think that there's obviously concerns that anybody who goes out into the street to protest against his appalling government will be dealt with brutally. So there's an element, I suppose, of frustration on her part, as there always is with a leader of the opposition in exile. But certainly it's a strong rallying call for people in Belarus to take action. I suppose it's difficult when they don't have her there to lead it. But, as I say, I think there ought to be more focus on this amazing, brave woman and on the struggle in Belarus. Mm.
Now, we were hearing earlier from Victoria in Ukraine about the loss of Mariupol, and we know that the final members of the Azov regiment have been bussed out. Lots of concern about where they're going, how they'll be treated and so on. And really, what she was telling us about Vladimir Zelensky saying, we lose this, this is the beating heart of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Very, very sad, very, very powerful. And the New York Times has a lovely piece. It says, rescuing the cuisine of besieged Mariupol. It's a recipe, a family recipe from the region. Tell us more.
It is a really lovely piece, I have to say. So Olga Koutsaridi is a graduate student advisor at the University of Texas. She grew up in Mariupol, which was then, of course, just a small city on the Black Sea. Her grandmother's apartment overlooked the mulberry trees lining Morsky Boulevard and the Sea of Azov beyond, we're told. And on the way to Mariupol's beaches, women sold whole roasted sunflower heads. Beachgoers hauled picnic lunches filled with garlicky salami sandwiches on lavishly buttered slices of baton, which is a staple Ukrainian bread. And on the way home, trucks sold freshly fried chebureki, I hope I pronounced that right, half moons of pastry folded around a meat filling, hot and spitting juice. It is the most wonderfully evocative piece, I have to say, I had my mouth watering. Mm. And it's just a wonderful example of how people try and hold on to hope, how they try and inspire each other. You know, food is all about home and homesickness, isn't it? It's about family and friends. It's about national identity as well. And so this story of one woman's attempt to keep these recipes alive, dumplings stuffed with sour cherries and farmer's cheese called tvorog. I knew I could go on and on. You know, food is about national identity. Perhaps I'm getting a bit misty-eyed here, but it's also about sharing, isn't it, and reconciliation. You wonder, perhaps one day, you know, Russians and Ukrainians will sort of sit down and eat together, and we will see some kind of reconciliation.
So what is she actually doing? She's collected all these recipes. She's been trying them out. She's been sharing them.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharing them online. She's joined what's described as a sourdough community, which I have to say, I never realised there's a whole community for sourdough enthusiasts. But she's
believe me, there is.
Okay, I'll bow to your greater knowledge on that. But yes, and she's, you know, obviously reaching out to other people, you know, who might, other Ukrainians. She has a business now as well. And I suppose it's really, she's just raising, I mean, there's a danger we get fed up with Mariupol and Ukraine, don't we, or whatever. So it's just wonderful. Here is a very warm, human sort of take on the story, if you like, and something which I think, I don't know, do we need to bake? Do we need to cook in support for Ukraine if we're hanging flags out of our window and raising money as well? But yeah, as I say, it's a lovely, heartwarming piece.
It certainly is. And all of this available, she's kind of created a database, really, of all of these recipes, and people can connect to them, make them. And I think you're right that cooking in this way perhaps gives us a sort of mindful opportunity to work through how we feel about it and to focus our concentration on everything that's been lost.
Absolutely. And also, I suppose, it gives us a sense of Ukrainian culture and literally a taste of Ukraine, the way Ukraine, isn't it? Because at the moment we do tend to associate it with horrendous pictures and maps of Russian progress and Ukrainian fight back. But I mean, how many of us, I mean, I love the idea, for instance, there's borscht is Ukrainian soup and borscht with the T on the end is Russian. So a bit like Kiev and Kyiv, you've got to get that right. But that sort of subtle difference of how a country maintains its culture, differentiates itself from Russia, and as I say, gives that hands, holds up that bit of hope that people might be able to get together and enjoy this wonderful, delicious food in Mariupol again.
Borscht or borscht, it's all beetroot.
Yeah, okay, Simon. Very good for you.
Simon Brook, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to get the latest tech news with Josh Coles, who's a researcher at the University of Oxford's Internet Institute. Josh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, I don't know if you remember in the playground and how well behaved you were as a small child, but when you fell out with somebody, sometimes, and I'm not saying it was you necessarily or indeed me, but some children would like to call their opponents a Mr. Poohead or something scatological like that. That's understandable when you're a small child. When you're talking about the richest person in the world and potentially one of the most powerful, isn't it a little odd to be tweeting poo emojis?
It's not a great look, is it? Particularly when $44 billion are on the line. So what you're talking about, what you're alluding to, of course, is Elon Musk, as you say, the richest person in the world, who over a month ago now struck a deal to buy Twitter for that amount of money, which at the time seemed pretty high and now probably seems even higher as a result of tech stocks really flopping over that time. Since then, as you say, Musk has got into a bit of a spat with Twitter's CEO regarding the amount of fake accounts on the platform, the proportion of accounts on Twitter that are fake, spam, bots or whatever else. And this has been suggested that it might be a convenient way out for Musk from the deal, owing to that slip in the value of tech stocks at the moment. But yes, his one emoji response to Twitter's latest claim about how many fake bots, fake accounts are on the platform, was, as you say, rather scatological.
I mean, we're still no closer, though, to knowing what Musk's end game is. I mean, was this ever serious for him? Has he suddenly realised that it's a lot of hard work and much less fun than trying to go to space?
I think that realisation might be taking hold. Yes, I mean, just weeks before this deal was agreed, Musk also speculated about setting up his own social network. I think the stakes involved in getting a platform off the ground like that would have seemed pretty high at the time. And I think that's when Musk perhaps pivoted to threatening to buy Twitter. But I think even from the start, this whole process has been very much a case of Musk working through and dealing with some of the bugbears that he faces on the platform. You know, he might face many, many bots because of who he is and because of how many followers he has, and also because of his involvement with crypto, which tends to attract a lot of scam accounts. So that, I think, might be why, as well as promising to allow editing tweets and things like that. It seems like Musk has taken on the role of aggrieved user, but of course has the pockets to follow through, potentially with a large amount of money. But whether he still wants to do that, we're going to find out, I suppose, in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, as you say, working through, in this case, possibly working through his digestive system. Let's talk about Texas now and the governor there. Now, again, another controversial law from Texas, this time targeting social media companies.
That's right. So late last year, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed into Texas law a bill that would essentially force social media companies to retain content on their platform that they editorially may disagree with or even find kind of disgusting, in the spirit of, as he would claim, sort of impartiality and transparency. That law was criticized at the time and continues to be criticized by tech companies who fear that it would completely overturn their systems of content moderation. In light of various events. Sadly, tragically, the shooting, which was racially motivated in Buffalo last week, that was live streamed online, and sadly many terrorist attacks today are. Tech companies scrambled to take that video down. They've had moderate success doing so. But this law might even potentially threaten to force them to keep stuff like that on social network platforms, which I think would give us all extreme pause. This, of course, is a Texas law, but if it were to be upheld by the Supreme Court, the tech groups have appealed now to the Supreme Court, it would force a bit of a change in the internet, perhaps in the same way that EU laws have forced changes in the other direction in terms of tech companies. So increasingly, companies like Facebook and Twitter, regardless of who owns Twitter, are being forced into these very politically motivated bills that push them in one way or the other. And it's really, I think, challenging their ability to operate these platforms effectively.
Josh, thank you very much indeed. That's Josh Coles there. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's show, we head to the Catalan capital of Barcelona to visit an historic building that's been given a fresh start, as well as a fresh perspective on one of its long-hidden facades. To explore what's going on beyond the street side, here's Monocle's David Stevens.
For many who visit or pass by a well-regarded piece of city architecture, a single facade is all that's available to admire. The other three walls are often less adorned, packed tightly against neighbouring structures, or locked away in quiet courtyards or alleyways. Barcelona's La Carboneria, however, is a structure graced with four facades, owing to the fact that its construction occurred while the city streets were still being drawn up. La Carboneria, originally designed as a housing estate, is the oldest building standing from Cerdà's groundbreaking Eixample plan from the mid-1800s. It was intended to sit between one of Cerdà's famous four-way junctions and a symbolic avenue that the town hall planned to cut diagonally across the map in line with the city's original defensive walls. Despite the fact that the street plan hadn't been finalised, construction of La Carboneria went ahead, and because of its position as an urban island of sorts, all of its faces needed to be presentable. Although the building was hardly decorative, owing to the fact it was constructed around a time of economic depression and for humble purposes, it was no less beautiful. But, as tensions between Cerdà and the town hall grew, the avenue idea was scrapped, and eventually the building was built into the corner of the block, hiding most of it away from the public. The next important chapter for La Carboneria came in the 2000s, when squatters began to occupy the building. The impromptu residents contributed enormous artistic works to the facades, resulting in the building becoming one of the most photographed in Barcelona. Not an easy task, considering it was competing with Gaudí's architectural masterpieces dotted across the Catalan capital. In 2014, the squatters were evicted from the space, but their occupation and the previous owner's attempts at eviction had left the building in disrepair and without a stairwell. La Carboneria was set for demolition and seemed soon to be nothing more than a memory. The last chapter in this story, for now at least, brings us to today, where the building's refurbishment is almost complete. In 2015, the building was recategorised as being of historic and artistic interest, and the owners needed an architect to complete its rehabilitation.
I'm Ángel Borrego, and I'm an architect from Madrid. I studied architecture in Madrid and did a master's at Princeton, and I have an office of architecture in Madrid.
Borrego was chosen for the project, and his design reverted the one public-facing facade to resemble the 19th century original. But it's the courtyard hidden behind the building where the magic of the space can be seen. As a pigeon darted between the metal frames above, Angel described how the idea to reorient the space took shape.
We try to listen a lot to the stories that we find, and try to find in those things that you can work with. We try to find places where the most useful project can come from. And since we didn't have a stairwell, we thought about taking the stairwell outside of the building and put it into the corner of the two party walls, and from there access the new building.
This repositioned staircase forces visitors to approach the rear facade across walkways from a distance, and they're given a moment to regard the long-hidden facade-to-be that was never granted the grand avenue it was originally prepared for.
In a very practical and important way, the squatting history of the building, the recent, very recent squatting history, and then the study that was done to support its classification as a historical element, and the work that the owner did of tearing the stair down, gave us the clue and the stepping stone in order to put the stair outside of the building and have this view of the battleground facade.
Upon opening, La Carboneria will again fulfill some of its original purposes, not just as a housing project, but also as a building to be admired from every side, especially that which has remained hidden for so many years.
And that was Monocle's David Stevens. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Charlie Filmer-Court, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Emma Searle, and our researcher, Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager, Chris Oblakwa. Just a little pointer to what's coming up. Over the next couple of weeks on Meet the Writers, you get to meet Alice Sherwood. She has a new book called Authenticity, Reclaiming Reality in a Counterfeit Culture. And this tells stories of fraud, fakery, and realness across art, technology, business and nature. And she asks what authenticity is and isn't and why it matters. And I'll also be speaking to Sarah Winman. And this is quite an unusual take on a book because we're really concentrating on her audiobook. She used to be an actor and her recording of the audiobook is absolutely sublime. The book's called Still Life. She does every single voice, every single character, each one subtly different. It was an absolute joy to listen to. And so both of those authors will be speaking to me soon on Meet the Writers. And the current edition is with Charlotte Vandenbroek, who tells 13 stories of buildings whose architects killed themselves because of something that went wrong within the creation process. After the headlines, there's more news on the way. Briefing is live at midday. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.